BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, welcome to The Media Show. Today, where it's safe to advertise. Why some companies are running keyword blacklists to avoid their digital advertising sitting alongside news stories they believe are controversial. The future funding of public service broadcasting is a model being proposed in Ireland, one that others could follow, even the BBC. And a podcast network for children. Let me introduce you to our panel. Matt Deegan is here, who runs the Fun Kids digital radio stations. He's here to talk about that move into podcasts, among other things. It's been reported, Matt, that the Prime Minister's top advisor, Dominic Cummings, is advising those at the top of government to avoid appearing on the Today programme. I wonder if a fresh pitch from the breakfast show on Fun Kids might be in the offing.
There's always a place for him or the ministers on the Fun Kids breakfast show with Sean and Robot every morning. It's interesting, we have listeners who, when they get in touch with us, we have a bit of a crossover with Radio 4 from a listening basis, and they like a place that's safe in content, and that they don't have to worry about some of the news stories that are covered. They understand what they're going to get on the station. And I think there's an interesting bit about listeners, you know, sort of self-scheduling. Won't stop them listening to the guys from downstairs, but it means they might give us a bit of a listen as well.
Boris Johnson at 8:10.
It could work.
I can hear it now. Shona Ghosh is here, senior tech reporter at Business Insider. Welcome back.
Hello.
To the media show. This week, I'm guessing you've been reporting on the latest news about Apple's forthcoming TV service. And money is being thrown at this, isn't it?
Yes, although in the grand scheme of what Netflix et al. Are throwing at it, it's actually still a smaller amount of funding. We know that Apple is sitting on a huge cash pile, so it can afford to double and probably triple that amount. So who knows where it will go?
The morning show has been catching the eye, though, hasn't it? Tell us a bit about that and what's planned.
Yes, so the morning show is basically a bunch of adverts for what looks to be one of Apple's flagship shows has been going online. You know, you can see it on YouTube and Twitter and so on. And it's a show about the media starring Steve Carell, Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon, who are all three very big name Hollywood actors. And so that's the kind of draw, is that Apple's clearly capable of drawing in this kind of talent to make a flagship show. So that's pretty interesting that that's how they're staking their flag.
And the suggestion is that each episode of that is going to cost more than an hour of Game of Thrones?
Yes, or The Crown, I think it's being compared to as well. I don't think the costs have been broken down. I mean, clearly those are three very expensive people.
Yes, they don't come cheap.
No, they definitely don't come cheap. You know, audiences now expect extremely high production values, even when they're streaming. And so it now has to, you know, Apple is creating a new service, but it has to compete with very well-established services that are throwing huge amounts of money at this content, such as Amazon, Netflix, and all the established players who also, you know, spend huge amounts of money on making these programs look very beautiful. So they can't really come in at a lower level.
Mm. November's in the diary then, in that case. Let's start with an investigation published by the Wall Street Journal. Last week, the paper looked at the extent to which digital advertisers are now avoiding certain types of news stories with the use of keyword blacklists. These are lists of keywords associated with controversial topics, for example, racism, immigration, and Trump feature frequently. If an online news story contains one of those words, then the concerned advertiser steers clear of it. The Wall Street Journal found that some advertisers are now maintaining lists that stretch to over 1,000 keywords. So, in effect, it means publishers are now facing a boycott of regular news stories from the advertisers on which they depend, as those advertisers become ever more concerned about brand safety. Well, Lee Moulding is here, works for a company called Integral Ad Science. You know all about this. Advertisers come to you with their blacklists. I mean, these can run to, what, many sheets of paper? How do they look?
I mean, it's dependent on the advertiser, surely. But yes, they can be 10, 20, you know, 1,000, 2,000 words long. So yes, it's broad as it is long, yeah.
And what are they looking to avoid? What are they worried about?
I think they're worried about misplacement of their advertising and where the money's spent. I think they're concerned about brand association. And rightly so. And you know, they spend a lot of money. We've seen You know, the Times expose 18 months ago, and that's really snowballed in terms of where we are around brand safety now for advertisers. You know, I read a quote the other day that, you know, that the average CMO is only one tweet away from, you know, potentially losing his or her job. So it's there's a human element to it as well, which I think we need to address.
You mentioned the Times. I mean, this relates back, doesn't it, to extremist content, adverts appearing alongside it, the implications thereof being potentially disastrous for the advertisers.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, that's let's be honest, that's not an old, this isn't a new problem.
This is an old problem,
right? But you know, it's become more prevalent as we're seeing more of these issues exposed across multiple channels as well.
I know you've got a list in front of you. I'm going to ask you to tread carefully through it for reasons that this is still 4:30 in the afternoon. What kind of words appearing on it?
Yeah, so we pulled this list this morning, and this is our, you know, top 20 blocked keywords globally by advertisers. And the first 10 are not great, but I can certainly repeat them. So we have things like explosion, ISIS, terror. We have bomb, terrorist, murder, massacre, terrorism, kill, shooting, bombing, etc., etc.
Yeah, which are self-explanatory.
Absolutely.
But we're also getting into the political areas as well, aren't we? I mentioned Trump. So people might now see a reference to Donald Trump, if they're an advertiser, and think, I don't want to be alongside that.
No, they don't. And also, you know, let's be honest, Farage is now kind of a highly blocked keyword as well. And I think, as I said, advertisers, you know, are very, very careful and conscious about where they want their advertising money spent. Now, you know, the argument could be that, you know, we don't want to live in a society whereby, you know, we're curtailing, you know, the press and what the press can actually release. And
yeah,
I don't think we're yet there yet, but I know certainly some of the major publications that we work with have expressed concern around that.
Is there any thought in your mind that they're being a bit too careful here? I mean, you know, the likes of Donald Trump and Nigel Farage are significant figures in our world, whether we like it or not. And to distance yourself from having an advert alongside a story that merely refers to them seems a little bit overcautious, doesn't it?
Yes, potentially. You know, to caveat, as a technology, as a piece of technology that's used by advertisers and publishers, we're not there to be judge or jury.
Sure.
We're there to be the technology that the advertiser looks to make the best out of its ad placement and advertising spend. But yes, I can certainly relate to the issues that publishers are certainly raising. Yeah.
Shona, how aware are you of this, and where does it go potentially, do you think?
So I'm not aware of publishers changing their content to appease advertisers or advertiser concerns. I think that's something that, you know, is a sort of golden rule that you very much try not to do that. I think what irritates me a bit is that Times investigation, which was great, referred to YouTube. It didn't refer to traditional publishers. So obviously publishers do have to write stories that are, I hesitate to use the words offensive, but controversial. They deal with controversial topics, but these are fact-based, hopefully, and for the most part, objective news stories. It is not some random YouTuber rambling on, or, you know, sort of the point of the Times article was that these were kind of random videos which were associated with terror content, and there was no editorial in place checking what they were, and that's how these ads went up against them. It's not the same in a publisher environment. So I feel irritated that advertisers are carrying over their concerns around platforms that say that they're not media platforms and they say they're not publishers, over to actual publishers who do exercise editorial control over what's live.
And concerns that potentially have financial implications, Lee, because if an advertiser says, I don't want to go on that particular site or alongside that particular story, less money comes into the organisation that's putting the journalism out there, the journalism might ultimately suffer.
Yeah, I think that's one of the greatest ironies, sure. And certainly some of the publishers that we've been speaking to are now looking at, so for example, any kind of breaking news content, you know, there is now a strategy in place whereby ads won't be placed alongside it until it's properly vetted. So there is a direct revenue implication against not doing that.
And on specific advertisers, I mean, you mentioned, for example, some that are avoiding the word Farage. Do we know who? Do you know who?
I do, and but I wouldn't want to list those.
No, okay, fair enough. But I mean, it's interesting that it's happening.
Absolutely, and you know, the another example is, think about the emissions scandal.
Sure.
For example, so you know, we're talking about brand safety, we're talking about keyword blocking in a negative context, which I fundamentally get, but also there can be a positive aspect to this as well. So you can target towards content that is suitable to your brand as well. But yeah, we work with automotive brands that don't want to appear against, for example, emissions-based content, and can target away from that as well.
Right. So if you're wanting to market a car, for example, you don't necessarily want something that says emissions are bad sitting alongside it.
Exactly. But then if you want to target an audience or a purchaser of a test drive or a specific motoring vehicle, then you can use it in a way whereby you can use that targeting to get closer to that purchaser potentially.
Is there anything in the argument that says that at the moment, at least, this seems to be a bit of a blunt instrument, because clearly most of these words could appear in all manner of entirely innocuous articles?
Yes, I think that's fair. And that has certainly surfaced over the last few months, primarily obviously from publishers. And I think as content verification tools, as that's what we list ourselves as being, you know, we have a duty to ensure that our technology covers you know, every eventuality. So, you know, we're starting to think about context, for example, and how we can target to context as well as part of our kind of longer product roadmap.
There's also something called a sentiment analysis moderator, isn't there, which basically determines the mood of the reader once he or she has read the content of a given article.
Yes, that's certainly part of other providers' technology and tools. I think if you're looking at how our technology...
But how does it work? I mean, on the basis of what a reader reads, how can that reader's mood then be determined?
I mean, there's an algorithm behind it, a fairly sophisticated, you know, one of those pesky algorithms behind it. And there's certainly a lot of kind of AI investiture behind it as well. As IAS, you know, we have you know, several ways of providing protection to advertisers, and that's looking at what's within the content and how an advertiser appears against that content and what risk association with that content they're happy with. And then there's the other part, which is the keyword piece, and it's almost like the two can compete against themselves. Sometimes we would encourage the advertisers that we're looking at to, you know, look at their lists. Are they being do they go through the lists, do they strip out keywords that are old, for example? So for example, we work with advertisers that still have Ariana Grande or London Bridge within their keyword list. That's not good. You know, that was at least 2 years ago.
Those who have them should at least refresh them.
Absolutely. And that's something we need to encourage. And again, that's on the advertisers to do that.
Shona, keywords and then mood of readers being examined as well. You looked sceptical as you heard that.
I looked a little... I just think the term sentiment analysis is a little... I don't know. How can you capture the nuance of what a reader is thinking? There's obviously going to be some news stories where it's clear that the impact on the reader will probably be a negative or a positive one. But for many stories, it's going to be a highly nuanced reaction depending on their, for example, political stance. So I think that is a little tricky. And I think a lot of these, maybe I'm very sceptical about AI and the promises of AI. I'm sure there will be more sophisticated tools in time that can determine those things, but I'm a little sceptical for now.
As a brief final thought, is this just a digital issue? Because clearly adverts appear alongside printed editions of newspapers and the same does not seem to apply.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And personally, from my point of view, I think it's very much a digital issue, yeah.
Okay. Lee, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
From digital advertising to a future funding model for public service broadcasting, which is being proposed in Ireland. The TV licence system, similar to the one which operates in the UK, would be replaced by a fee that applies to a mobile, a laptop, a tablet. In other words, any device that might give you access to television and radio programmes. The idea is that it would more accurately correlate with people's modern-day viewing and listening habits. But it's not without its critics. In a moment, you'll hear from Laura Slattery, a media journalist with the Irish Times. First, Dee Forbes, Director General of Ireland's public service broadcaster, RTE, who guided me through her organisation's current funding system.
Since the beginning of RTE's existence, it's been a dual-funded model. About 50% of revenue comes from commercial advertising. We have two TV channels who between them serve the entire population, and we have some radio services as well. So we can sell advertising across the piece, and 50% from the license fee. That has been changing over the last number of years because both revenue streams have been challenged. There has been an ongoing downturn in the advertising market, coupled with increased evasion in this marketplace. So we have some very, very particular challenges.
Laura Slattery, let me bring you in on what is being proposed by the government in the context of what we've just heard from Dee Forbes. This is to replace the, quote, TV licence with a, and I quote again, device-independent broadcasting charge from 2024. How would you enforce a system whereby the mere ownership of a phone or a tablet or a computer would require you to pay some sort of lump sum?
Well, this is the big question. And so far, our Minister for Communications has openly said he doesn't know how he would enforce this. So what they've said is it would be a device independent charge. But we don't know yet. Does that mean that there is a list of some devices that bring you into the eligibility loop? Or is it a household charge where every household in the country pays something?
And he wouldn't want to call it a household charge, would he? Even though he wouldn't. It would effectively become one. So give us a little bit of context as to why we've got to this point now.
This is an idea that's been knocking around for almost a decade already, which is an acknowledgement, really, that there's a growing proportion of people who aren't using a traditional TV set to watch television content. As we speak, it's about 10% of households that don't use a traditional TV set. And essentially, that means there's tens of millions of euro that could be going to RTE or to public service broadcasting in Ireland that isn't, because those households aren't making a contribution. So there's been a kind of a political move and also support across the industry for a change in the definition of who should pay to support public service broadcasting. But unfortunately, I think the support, you know, at political level and possibly in across sections of the public is really only theoretical. When it comes to actually going ahead and introducing it, it's a little bit more hazy.
I wanted to get into that. The broadcasters broadly, you say, quite like the sense of possible change here because of some of the funding problems that Dee Forbes mentioned a moment ago. The wider reaction is what?
I suppose you would see flare-ups of hostility whenever this is mentioned. People who aren't currently eligible to pay a television licence fee, again, because they maybe don't have a TV, don't like the idea of being brought into this loop. I think younger audiences, you know, they just don't remember, I guess, the original rationale for public service broadcasting. Although RTE has always faced competition from overseas broadcasters, including the BBC, now the competition is just so vast, and some younger people might even ask, why do we need RTE? They're maybe not as familiar with the economics of it.
Dee Forbes, do you accept the doubts that exist, especially among younger listeners and viewers who might, frankly, not watch RTE or listen to RTE and might think, why, if I've got a phone in my hand, do I suddenly have to pay a lump sum for it?
You know, a lot of research we have done and a lot of anecdotal evidence we have is that, yes, when people are younger, they may not see the value, perhaps, of their national broadcaster. However, that does change as you get a little bit older. But also, I think what we are seeing now is that there is real engagement from younger audiences with our content. We recently launched an RTE player here, akin to the iPlayer in the UK, and we're getting incredible traction on that player. So I think it's not as if the younger audiences are not watching. I think what they want to be able to do is watch when they want, where they want.
There is a point here, isn't there, about if funding is tight, if a new model is being looked at, there will be some who say, frankly, RTE, do a little bit less than you do now. How do you respond to that?
We've been operating with 100 million less a year in funding since 08. So, you know, unfortunately, we have had to do a little bit less over the years. And I think right now it's important to say that we are in a review process to really try and see what needs to happen to sustain the organisation. We have been doing everything we can to protect content, to ensure that, you know, as much money as possible goes on the screens and on the airwaves. But we have come to a place where it's just not simply feasible to continue as we are.
A word about the wider public service model, finally. Laura Slattery, when you look at what's being proposed here, could it potentially be something that others not only look at around the world, but potentially follow?
We would say in Ireland that we are behind even where you are with the BBC, in the sense that you don't have to pay a licence fee here for using the RTE player, the on-demand player, the same way you do if you have to register for the iPlayer in the UK. So we would say, rather than people following us, we're still maybe playing catch up on in some areas. But, you know, as we don't know what's going to happen over the next 5 to 10 years in terms of how viewers consume content, but we can guess that it's going to involve a vast array of devices. So there needs to be a broader definition and a looser definition, and we need to sort of address this pretty soon, I would say, because otherwise this kind of background crisis is going to really sort of take its toll on national culture.
Laura Slattery, media journalist at the Irish Times. You heard as well Dee Forbes, Director General of RTE. Quick thought, Shona, on this public service funding model. Is there anything there, do you think, that others might follow?
It's interesting that the point about being behind the BBC. I remember the period of I briefly didn't own a TV for a few years just because I moved into a flat and was too lazy to get hold of one. So I was watching iPlayer on my laptop, and for a while didn't have to pay a licence fee. I did, and I know the BBC clamped down on that sort of stuff, but it did make sense to me. But I think it involved tapping into a nostalgia that I already had for the BBC, so I didn't feel too upset about it, other than, you know, okay, well, it's probably about time I do pay that fee. And I think that's to the point about culture, is you really need to believe, you know, to bring the public with you, you need to believe that the state broadcaster or the state media provider is sort of necessary to the culture, and that's why you pay that money. So you have to sort of tap into that belief, don't you? Which I think I feel the BBC has done very well.
Now, I mentioned Matt Deegan, among other things, runs Fun Kids, the digital children's radio station. Here is a brief flavour of it, a clip from George's holiday show.
It was actually revealed this week that One Direction star and man who wears curtains for clothes, Harry Styles, has turned down the role of Prince Eric in Disney's upcoming live-action remake of Little Mermaid. It's disastrous. And there was me thinking, Harry and Ariel were made for each other.
I can hear that just before Boris Johnson at 8:10. Yeah. Now, Fun Kids has branched into children's podcasts. It's just launched the Fun Kids Podcast Network. What is it? What's going to happen?
So two things, I guess. So Fun Kids has always made podcasts. We've been doing that for a number of years. And it's popular and it's growing, just as podcasting is growing. And when we talk to other people in the sector who made kids content, what we found out was that they suffer from some of the things that we did in our early days. You know, how do they monetize it? How do they pay to make that content for their effort at a time when maybe the audience is growing? And what we thought was, actually, if we could bring some of those podcasts all together, use our sales team and our relationships with providers like Apple Podcasts and Spotify, we can help those grow their audience, but also create a business model around what they do, and also allow sort of anybody in this space to launch children's podcasts quicker. If you look at all the podcasts in the UK, you know, certain categories that do very well, you know, we hear a lot about true crime or comedians and comedy podcasts, and parenting is a hugely successful kind of vertical in the podcast space. And we see kids content behind but growing, and in markets like America, where there's been more kids content in the podcast form, those have been more successful.
And kids content under a number of what different headings? So entertainment, education, a lot of different areas.
Absolutely. And so for Fun Kids, we do, you know, book shows, science programming, but there's story programming in there as well. And we see that from other operators too. We've been working with The Week Junior, which is a magazine for 6 to 8 to 14-year-olds. And so we're working with them to do a weekly kind of news and current affairs show. And that's something that they've got excellent skill and talent in doing that, and we've helped them make that into an audio show.
I confess it amused me this morning when I read that programme helps children make sense of the world, and I wrote down here, good luck with that.
Well, also, a lot of parents have been saying, well, yes, it's been useful for
everybody
them
wants to make sense of the world. What about the funding model? How does that look?
So Fun Kids is a commercial operation, and the broadcast radio station has been commercially funded, and we're going to do the same thing for the podcast network. It's interesting listening to what we've heard so far. You know, when we talk to advertisers, you know, brand safety is hugely important, particularly around children's content. And for advertisers, historically, they've had a great platform for advertising to families, and that's television. And most people watched ad-funded children's television. But because of the rise of Netflix and other services, actually, it doesn't reach all children like it used to. And some of those ad buyers now have to look at a whole variety of platforms, you know, what they do on YouTube, what they do on digital platforms. And actually, now they can reach children through our national radio station or through our podcast network too. Mm.
So your keyword blacklist, Lee, would not apply here.
We need to take out, make sure Peppa Pig is right in that list.
Yes, it doesn't apply.
It doesn't.
No. What about the growth in podcasts, particularly aimed at young people, Shona, and the massive rise it appears to be in this area?
Yeah, it's really interesting the diversity of content that's now available and diversity of distribution platforms. You know, my friends are all sort of becoming new parents, and I interestingly see them desperately scrambling for safe media to put in front of their kids, because YouTube is a bit of a wild west still. I know it's got a YouTube Kids dedicated app, but sometimes that can lead you down to a weird spiral of dark places. And so, you know, they really, and I think, to be honest, it can be very lucrative for the providers if they can guarantee a safe environment, because parents will pay you know, quite a lot of money to get hold of an app that's completely safe, and they can perhaps leave their kids with for an hour or so, you know, while they're on a flight or on a car journey. So I think it makes perfect sense.
That point about it being lucrative if you get it right.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you build scale and you're trusted, then you can do well. I mean, what we know is that 41% of 9 to 14s have listened to a podcast, and 19% listen to something each week. So it's a significant chunk of kids are already jumping into that space.
Going back to what you said about the Week Junior show, and I know I was being slightly flippant about understanding the world, but there is an element, or it seems to me there's an element of public service about what you're doing, something almost sort of old-fashioned about it, something maybe that ought to be coming out of this building.
Yes, I mean, we think so new kids audio from anybody, including the BBC, would be a good thing. Mm. A rising tide carries all ships. I think what we think about with children is at school, they get exposed to a huge amount of stuff. Science, literature, life, learning, music, pop culture. And the job of our radio station is to reflect all of those things, as is what we do in the podcast space too.
And there'll be more coming into this sort of podcast umbrella in the coming...
Yes, so there's more launches coming in the next few months, and some other partners are joining with us as well.
Right, so we can look out for more developments in the coming weeks and months. Thank you very much indeed. That is it for today's programme. Don't forget, of course, you can always subscribe to the Media Show podcast on BBC Sounds. It seems appropriate to mention podcasts in the light of the last conversation. You will never miss an episode if you do. Many thanks to all of my guests today. Thanks to Lee Moulding.
Thank you.
And for bringing your list in and treading carefully as you read it. Thanks to Shona Ghosh and to Matt Deegan. Thank you very much for listening. The Media Show back at the same time next week.